It's always surprising and insightful to listen to people who aren't you.
Welcome to the User Defenders Podcast, where we interview successful UX designers who fight for the user in order to inspire and equip you to do the same. And now, here's your host, Jason Ogle.
Greetings, User Defenders. Welcome to episode 9. I cannot believe I just interviewed Josh Clark, Dr. Touch, as his superhero name is. More context to that, to those of you who may not know him. I have a feeling most of you do or have heard of him. What a tremendous interview. What a tremendous guest. I am not going to delay any further because there's just so much good stuff in following in this interview. So without further ado, let's jump right into it. Josh Clark is a designer specializing in mobile design, strategy, and user experience, especially as it relates to touch. He's the founder of the powerful design laboratory Big Medium, formerly Global Moxie. He's the author of 5 books, including the O'Reilly published Tapworthy and the newly released A Book Apart published, Designing for Touch. He's also a prominent blogger and speaker, the creator of the popular Couch to 5K running program, and he happens to be Maine's 11th strongest man, and I'd love to learn more about that. Josh, welcome to the show. I'm super excited to have you.
I am really happy to be here, and I should make a caveat. While I'm very proud to be Maine's 11th strongest man, I should confess that there were only 10 other people in the competition. So, and one of them was like half lame. So but they can't take number 11 from me.
That's right. They can't take that away from you. Sounds like a Whitney Houston song, right?
That's right.
That's awesome, man. So every superhero has a secret identity, and let's talk about yours. I'd like to start the show by you taking a few moments to give us a look into your personal life.
Wow. Well, I'm recently married to Liza Kindred, who is someone who actually, her work really overlaps really neatly with mine. She works in fashion and technology and sort of trying to figure out how these sort of two most personal worlds of self-expression on the fashion side and glamour and sort of aspiration fit with this sort of functional world of technology. And it's this sort of bridge between physical and digital that also really intrigues me. So there you go. That's our pillow talk.
Wow.
We have an extraordinary daughter who's about to turn 16 named Veronica. And she teaches us stuff every day, I would say, about how technology can work and new ways that we can interact with each other. She's an extraordinary young woman and has quite a few superpowers herself.
That's great, man. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
And talk about the marriage of form and function, right?
There you go. It's like literally the marriage of form and function.
That's wonderful. Thanks for sharing that. Tell us your starting out story. What inspired you to pursue UX design as a career, Josh?
Well, so my working life began before the internet was mainstream, before the web began. And I worked as a TV producer and filmmaker at WGBH in Boston, making public television documentaries for National PBS. And that's something that, at the time was, I really engaged by doing the storytelling. And that was the way, TV was the way you would touch a lot of people. It was frustrating, though, as being young in my career, because, it was public television, funds were limited. They didn't just give a few million dollars to just anybody to make your own show. And so I knew it was going to be a while before I would have the kind of means and support to do that. And at the same time, it was a very sort of rigid formula, at least at the time, for how you create a documentary. Sort of here's the Ken Burns recipe. Mm. And while I learned a lot doing it, it also began to feel sort of rigid. So in two ways, I was feeling this kind of inflexibility in my sort of creative life there, working for television at the time. And right about then, the web sprang into the world. And it was like, wait a second, this is like this really interesting new form of storytelling that hasn't yet been defined and that anyone can really get into. And at the time, in terms of user experience, it was really the Wild West. I mean, there was no user experience. It hadn't been defined. It was just kind of climb into this crazy, and then it was called the internet or the information superhighway, right?
But
there were no road signs, there were no rules of the road. And so it was this at once, you know, kind of wonderful, unregulated place to run around. But it also was really chaotic and with very few kind of rules. And so I leapt into it with the band and through a series of jobs before running out on my own and starting my own development and design shop called Global Moxie at the time. And as you mentioned, I've since changed that to Big Medium.
Yes. I love that that union, another perfect union, the storytelling and UX, because that is so important these days in creating an experience, because there's so much noise, right? The signal to noise ratio is so high now, with so much saturation out there. And it's really important to tell a good story that people are actually interested in.
Yeah. And I think it's important too, to actually find out their story and tuck your technology into that rather than imposing your story on people, which I think is frankly something that we're having a lot of right now. You know, that engagement is what everyone wants from the business side. And, you know, in a sense, we're over-engaged, right? I mean, there's our technologies are really distracting. They are designed for addiction.
Yeah.
We have this situation now where on average, we're looking at our screens 3 hours and 16 minutes per day. That's 20% of our waking lives that we spend gazing into our little glowing rectangles. And, you know, that's something that, I am by no means negative about the power of technology and certainly of mobile.
Sure.
I think it's been incredibly empowering. But at the same time, we've lost something, you know, right? That they're super distracting. That is, everyone is trying to solve problems with screens. It means that we can't escape screens either. And so how can we start to create those, you know, find the stories of people's lives where technology can dip in just as it's needed and get out of the way just as quickly, instead of kind of trapping people's attention with external stories.
Such great points there. And I feel like with all these distractions, it's what you just shared and your mission in this work is inspiring to me and all of us, is that we need to make it count. So I appreciate that a lot.
Yeah. How do you make it meaningful to people's lives? Right now we have a lot of novelty and distraction, which I think is natural in a young industry, which ours still very much is, of sort of figuring out how it works, what the role is, sort of going for the flashy.
Yeah.
And we can't resist it as users either. We tend to blame ourselves a lot about our inability to tear ourselves away from the screens. But my friend Golden Krishna, who's written a wonderful book called The Best Interface is No Interface, sort of points out that, you know, this is the world that we've created as designers, that the world is designed to be built around screens. And so it's on us as the people who've maybe done our jobs a little too well to find some new ways to empower people without necessarily gluing them so much to screens.
Josh, if you weren't doing this for a living, what would be your second career choice and why?
Oh man, what a great question. I think it would have to do with some kind of storytelling or teaching. I love pulling together disparate ideas and finding a common thread to them. So, you know, much as I was sort of saying that I felt a little chased out of the documentary world, I mean, that's something that kind of thing of sort of pulling together different scenes and to tell a story that hopefully can make a difference or provide some insight is really has always been exciting to me.
Mm. Who has been the biggest inspiration in your work and why?
Wow. Let me see. That's a good question. You're looking for my origin story.
I am. We want to tell your story and get to know you personally first.
Yeah. You know, I mean, early on in my career, back before, you know, my internet days, I was working with the PBS NewsHour, which was at the time called the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour. And I worked with two producers, a correspondent named Paul Solman and a producer named Laurie Cohen, who both of them, you know, gave me a lot of encouragement and agency and sort of editing pieces and, you know, really starting to tell stories for a national audience. And I just remember Paul, who I considered being very successful. He sometimes sat in the anchor chair of the show to fill in for the main anchors. He was right up there saying, there is no big time. There's always sort of something ahead. And he was talking about a couple of things. One is the idea that we often fool ourselves into thinking, oh, if I just get to here, I'll be happy. I will have made it. And there's always sort of something ahead. So I think he was telling me at the time that you can't chase those false goals. You have to find some happiness and satisfaction in the thing that you're doing and making right now, which is not to say that you shouldn't, push yourself, that you shouldn't sort of set these ambitions for yourself, but that there's no happiness in thinking that you'll only be happy when you reach one of those goals, because there's always another one around the corner. Which I think that was something that I remember him just telling me that almost casually, and just like it really had this big effect on me. And I think reminded me that there's importance to no matter what you achieve or don't achieve, finding satisfaction in what you do and having humility in your achievements is really important.
Love that. And I actually had Ben Callahan on the show last week. I interviewed him last week. And one of the things he said to the next question I'm going to ask you is what's one habit that you believe contributes to your success? I think what he said was something about every day I wake up, the first thing I do is I think about what matters today. And so I love that. And yeah. You touched on that too, with just all the noise and just thinking about what matters and how can you make a difference in somebody's life through your work.
Ben is so wonderfully thoughtful about that stuff. This sort of, he is a superhero in these things and has this just sort of quiet thoughtfulness that is wonderful.
Yes, I agree. Now, this is your question now, Josh. What's one habit that you believe contributes to your success?
Man, I wish I had better habits. I think that... a lot of it is making time to play and experiment and just sort of think. And I think that for exactly the things that you were saying, that there's sort of so many distractions, all of our to-do lists are crazy. I don't know a single person who doesn't feel like they're redlining, that the world is just, sort of wants from them. And so sometimes it can feel like procrastination to do something that's sort of like, I'm just going to like do something that's not directly related to the stuff that I have to do, but that lets me sort of find out how this technology works in this context, or playing with new interactions, or just spending some time reading and thinking about other people's experiments. I just think that it's so important right now as our industry evolves and moves into new media, in a sense, digital crossing over into physical and vice versa, that we splash in the puddles and give ourselves permission to play and think about things that aren't necessarily immediately obviously applicable to our work, but very much in the medium of things. So with mixed success, I try to carve out specific times of the day and of the week to read and think and sort of put everything else aside. And I have this small group of people that we get together on the weekend when we can to just hack on things and just sort of have a couple hours to, have a beer and play with an Arduino and sort of see what happens in a way that's just as I said, splashing in the puddles.
That's good. And we need that to break out of our ruts, to really stretch ourselves. And I'm writing a piece right now just about design trends, how we kind of have sort of found ourselves at this place where so a lot of stuff really looks the same. So it's, I'm just thinking about new ways to sort of how can we create different output. I think it's by receiving different input as well. So I appreciate that answer.
That is such a great... That's such a great point. I mean, and that's true in so many things. It's like, where do we find our inspiration? Games and toys can be incredible points of inspiration for thinking of new ways to attack problems and interaction in sort of more serious realms. But I mean, their whole thing is about I think game designers are some of the best interaction designers we've got. Their whole brief is what is going to be fun and delightful, easy to pick up. You don't have to read the manual. It's going to be novel, but not necessarily for the sake of novelty. There's just like so much inventiveness there. And that if we can kind of put ourselves into that playful state of mind, we can often come up with really good experiences in other realms too. But I think another part, this is another thing I think that's coming up in our industry a lot, is sort of diversity of voices. And it's human nature to hang out with people who are like us. I mean, that is the comfortable route. And that's with people who share a point of view, who look like us, who came from where we did, who work in the same thing. And the work that we do is too important for that. We're designing things that are for the whole world. And unfortunately, so many of these decisions are being created and products being defined around the worldview of, wealthy white guys from a very sort of thin area of the world. And as a white guy who has some degree of privilege, I'm guilty of that. And I think one of the things that we need to do is find our blind spots, not just in what our design inspiration is and the designs that we create, but the people we spend time with or the people we follow on Twitter and the people we listen to, because it's always surprising and insightful to listen to people who aren't you.
Amen. Can you tell us about the one thing you're working on that you're most excited about?
Sure. The realm that I'm really excited about right now is how digital and physical are crossing over into each other. And so on one hand, I've written a new book, which you mentioned, called Designing for Touch, which is about how our digital interfaces are creating this real illusion of physicality, that we're not just sort of tapping pictures of information, but we are creating the illusion of stretching it and moving it and pulling it and crunching it. And you're really touching data itself. And on the other hand, so we've got our digital interfaces getting more and more physical, but we're also getting our physical interfaces, regular everyday objects and places, becoming more digital. And so the two are, with things like the Internet of Things and wearables like smartwatches and things like that, smart homes, these right. two sort of directions are burrowing in toward the middle and kind of converging on the smartphone. That's sort of right now the bridge that we have between digital and physical, this device that's powered by all these sensors and it's this information that we can carry out into the world, and the device can actually interact with the world immediately around us. So that sort of area is like super intriguing to me. That's like magic powers happening right there. And so some of the stuff that I've had the opportunity to experiment with, and I would say this still falls in the category of splashing with puddles, is I've been working with a small startup within the Samsung accelerator called Presto. And they're looking at what happens when you bring natural gesture to smartphones. So it's for the Android platform. And if you happen to have an Android Wear watch, you can control your phone with gesture. So an example would be, raising your arm, lowering your arm to adjust volume, for example. That kind of stuff is pretty straightforward with an accelerometer. But they've also got it so that it can detect when you snap your finger if you're wearing one of these watches, or flick your finger. Just these subtle impact that it makes, sort of the impact signature of snapping your finger versus flicking your finger against your thumb. They can detect that. And so you get these interesting experiences and experiments of, if my phone is running my music, I can start and stop my music by snapping my fingers, go to the next song by flicking my finger, raising the volume by raising my hand, which sounds like a goofy party trick, but it's amazing how powerful it feels even when you're just at home. It feels silly when you're on the bus, but it's like it's really fun when you're with other people, or just when you're at home across the room just to do this sort of... This kind of thing of not just sort of moving information across devices, which is what smartwatches are kind of doing, skimming information off your phone. What if you can push some sort of skim interaction off the watch and push that back to your phone? And since the phone is connected to so many things in your life, that means that with a casual gesture, you can have some impact on some other device a couple of connections down the road.
Wow, a lot of good stuff in that answer. Thinking about the gestures and how right now that might seem kind of awkward, but it's really going to become commonplace soon enough. You know, I think Minority Report and all that, so long ago, but we are in those times. This is such an exciting time to be a UX designer. So this is all going to be commonplace. Perhaps not iPad to take photos yet, though. I don't think we're ready for that. So let's get into your transformation, Josh. Every superhero has to go through some sort of transformation when they realize the powers they have and they use them for the greater good. So let's talk about your design superpower.
Well, I would say that my superpower is the ability to leap boundaries between platforms. So I can bound between phone and watch and I can burst through the walls of physical and digital. That's sort of the thing that I think most engages me right now is how do we make it easy for somebody who is on their phone to transition easily to an in-person, you know, retail experience, for example. How do I, if I'm on my desktop and I want to take that information to go with me, move that easily over to my phone? And sort of this fluidity between these platforms is I think that's my superpower, melting between platforms.
Love it. Adversely, what's your design kryptonite?
I think that I would say that it is probably technology itself, which is probably a funny thing to say. I think that there is a tendency that I feel as a technologist and that I certainly recognize in others to say, here is this technology, what is the problem I can solve with it? In other words, you fall in love with the solution instead of falling in love with the problem.
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, and I see that, you see that a lot. You see that in client work, or your boss is like, you know, we got to have that carousel on the front page without necessarily saying, well, what's the problem what are we trying to accomplish with that carousel? You know, what's the problem we're trying to solve? We often leap to the solution.
Yeah.
And you see this in so many ways. We're seeing this right now with wearables, I think. Google Glass is a great example where it was a technology approach where they were like, you know, we got these little screens and these tiny processors and this little camera. Man, what happens if we put it on your face? You know, it's like bashed people in the face with this technology and sort of saying, you know, what if these glasses were magic? You know, what are glasses for? What's their contextual role, both emotionally and culturally, as well as physically? You know, what is it about magic vision, for example? How can we make them more of what they are? How can we make the person more of what they are? And instead, you know, it was sort of more of an experiment of putting technology on different sites of your body. And it's a fine line to cross, because on the one hand, like I said, we need to experiment. We need to prototype and play and see what these different technologies can do. I think, though, that right now a lot of these experiments are being hustled out in sort of, you know, and put on the great altar of the MVP as products instead of sort of as experiments to sort of refine. And I think that we're being a little too easy with putting out half-baked technology ideas into the world instead of really trying to say, you know, what's the problem that we can solve, and starting and building out from that instead of from the technology in.
Yes, defenders, be aware of solutions in search of problems. Absolutely. What would your UX design superhero name? And let me caveat this question, because nobody gets there alone. We all need each other. We all need others. You know, even, you know, Superman had Lois Lane, Batman had Alfred, you know, but what would your UX design superhero name be?
Well, you know, I feel like I've already been given one, and I'm not crazy about it, but sometimes you don't get to choose your own name, which is the mighty Jeffrey Zeldman often calls me Dr. Touch, both in email and when he introduces me at his thing. So it sounds a little creepy. It sounds probably like it might be more super villain, but he calls me Dr. Touch. And, you know, it's not the one I would have chosen for myself, perhaps, but there you go. You don't always get to choose.
That's good. No, that makes perfect sense, though. I love it.
This is Ben Callahan, the president of Sparkbox, and you are listening to the User Defenders Podcast.
Tell us a story about your biggest failure in your career, Josh. And I know this is a part that we don't like to think about it, but it is so important to shape who we are and the work we do and how we grow in our character and things. But would you mind sharing us a story of just a place and a time and a place in your career where you just felt like this was kind of the biggest sort of failure?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that my biggest failure was one that rolled out in slow motion over the course of many years, which is when I first went out on my own, and this was, I guess, in 2002, I had the idea of creating a content management system. And at the time, this was before WordPress. Movable Type was out there as a blogging platform. But for most things, if you wanted a content management system, they were these things that you had to go out and pay for a custom system, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And I had come out of a business where that had cost us, like sort of the inability to get a content management system rolling was expensive and it didn't work well and it just hobbled us. And so I was like, you know, this has got to be an easier way. I just, you know, use some simple homegrown technologies and roll a content management system, sell it on the cheap for like $100 to make it designer friendly so that designers could create designs, plug their design into this system and roll it out. And, you know, I tried for, I guess, about 6 or 7 years to make this thing a success. I had some moderate success, but as WordPress and Drupal and all these other things came on, it became something that was more and more of a non-starter, that these things became sort of the de facto standards. And so while I had, you know, tens of thousands of sites running on it, it wasn't enough at $100 a pop to make a going career. And I was dogged in it. I just kept after it, even though all the signs were saying this can't work. You know, the opportunity has passed, and it wasn't either financially or creatively interesting. I just kind of burrowed in and sort of put my head in the sand in a few different ways. One of not recognizing that this thing, this business, this product wouldn't fly, but also just being very sort of isolated in terms of, all right, if I just work harder, just like, you know, kind of isolating myself. And so for years, I sort of went into this little hole of obscurity, really working on this little obscure product, content management system, until I finally said, you know, I got to do something else. And it was about the time that the iPhone came out that I said, this is something that is brand new. And one of the things that came out of it as a positive thing of me sort of spending those years working on this content management system is that I've looked at thousands of sites really carefully to understand what patterns were necessary to make, you know, kind of the 80% website successful. Mm-hmm. And so I became really, had developed a really careful eye through working on this failed product for what are the individual elements of user experience that make this successful. And after the iPhone came out, I did sort of a similar thing, just looking at and examining all of the patterns of this emerging new medium, and wrote a book called Tapworthy that came out of that, which was really about, here's sort of the emerging best practices for user experience at the time, 2010. So, you know, I think like a lot of superhero stories, you have this kind of cataclysmic failure, you know, you fall into the bath of gamma rays, you know, whatever, and it just sort of seems like that's the end.
Right.
You sort of find something in those ashes to take with you.
Mm. Oh, that's good. What do you want our listeners to take away from that story, Josh?
Well, I think that there are a couple of things. One is that it's okay to fail, you know, and I think that sometimes maybe failure is a little overrated. We have a lot of this idea that it's, but, you know, like I was saying at the outset, you know, there's no big time. Your life is not defined by the success or failure of any one project, and everything is just sort of a chapter in which there's another chapter that will follow that will be more or less successful, more or less of a failure. And you just sort of keep going, you know? And I think that sort of allowing yourself to recognize, you know what, this isn't working. It's okay to put that down. There's no sort of shame in that, and sort of find what you came out of that and move on to the next thing with lessons learned. But I think that we have a culture that on the one hand celebrates failure with this sort of fail fast mentality, which I think can be good, but I think also sometimes forgives a lack of thought, thoughtfulness.
Interesting.
And on the other hand, we also have this thing of kind of shame at failure. You know, we have a very unkind social media in some aspects of the technology world where, you know, we love to point at fails. And there's some sport in that. But that's something that we can't allow ourselves as people who are really trying to make something new to take on. And it's like, yep, not everything works. That's not a reflection of you. You know, either the applause or jeers is not a reflection on you. It's just feedback on the thing that you've made that you have to take forward. But that's a thing that I've often struggled with in my career is investing too much of my own self-worth and my own kind of image in either success or failure of a thing that I make. The things we make aren't who we are.
Yeah, a couple of takeaways for me on that. It's a quote I heard. I think Derek Sivers said it. If you're not failing, you're not trying hard enough.
Yeah.
And then also related to the unfortunate social media meanness out there, you know, I think for me, this is my quote, if you want to see the worst of humanity, just look at some YouTube comments.
Yeah. Man, the worst. Right? The worst.
So that's unfortunate.
But, you know, and I think the thing is to sort of think of everything we do is an experiment, you know? And I mean, I think that that's the real value underneath this MVP idea, which I think has sort of become a little bit of a thing of like, get it out fast and make a lot of money. And it's not what that is.
Right.
It's get it out fast so you can learn something because it's an experiment.
Oh,
you know, it's what's the minimum thing that you need to put out there to get some useful feedback so you can make the next thing. And, you know, I think that part of that is we have a natural tendency to think that the thing we make is kind of permanent. And we have a real luxury in the business that we work in that we can make changes, that everything doesn't have to be just right. Of course, we also have this sort of thing now where we're actually the people who are used to that sort of flexibility and agility of a digital medium moving more into integrating with a hardware medium, whereas there is not that agility. You know, so how do you find some of the thoughtfulness that has to go into that hardware world and foresight with the really flexible ability of the digital world to shift and change? So you get these interesting things now, right, where software can scale the hardware, where, you know, Tesla just shipped a software upgrade to all their cars, and boom, you got a new car. The same way it feels like you've got a new phone when, you know, the new version of Android or iOS ships.
Yeah, I don't think any of the websites I've designed but 3+ years ago are still live. None of our work is permanent. Great reminder. Do you have a story of something really crazy or super awkward that happened during user testing?
Well, you know, I'm happy to say that most usability testing has gone pretty straightforward, just because for the most part it's pretty well planned out in terms of who we want to have there and you know what we want to look at. There was one time though that somebody slipped through the cracks, and we got this homeless guy who showed up, and he, you know, he clearly hadn't showered in a while, which is neither here nor there.
Sure.
A lot of developers. But you know, he was a guy who was clearly not our, we were looking for, this was for a technology site, it was for early adopters, and this guy, I clearly didn't have the means to do that, but
not your target demographic.
That's right. That's right. And so because of this, we were in San Francisco doing this, and on one hand, it was a little refreshing because it's like, wow, here is a human being who has enterprisingly figured out how to make some extra money by looking at a screen for half an hour. And you know, and so while we didn't really get that target demographic out of it, we did get sort of some really sort of basic human usability stuff of sort of a newcomer to this world, and sort of got some insight there. But at the end, you know, we were giving away these Amazon gift cards, and he was like, "Hey, listen, I'm having a little bit of a hard time, and if it would be possible to get, instead of a card for Amazon, maybe something that could let me get some food, that would be great." And, you know, it was the kind of thing that on the one hand, you know, in the moment there's this, it just sort of shows how screwed up we can be sometimes as human beings. Mm. There's this, my first instinct was to be a little indignant that he had kind of bent the rules of the system.
Sure.
On the other hand, it's like, you know, good on this guy. He, you know, is trying to figure out something to work. He's figured out this wacko world of San Francisco internet, where there's sort of so much excess around him, and that he's sort of figured out how to do something. So, you know, I pulled out the wallet and gave him some cash instead of the thing, you know, so more power to that guy. But that was an unexpected user testing experience for sure.
Oh man, that is, I'm moved by that story, Josh. Thank you for sharing that. A great kind of break away from the norm and kind of stepping back from your work and just realizing that they're humans first and then they're users second, right?
Yeah, and this is what I was talking about when, you know, earlier too. It's, you know, talk to people who aren't you. You know, it's like, right. I talk to a lot of people who are in this like early adopter world, you know, and so it was a little bit refreshing to sort of talk to somebody who was so far outside of that world, and I was glad to be able to help him in some small way in exchange for his help.
Absolutely. Josh, one of my favorite lines from Tron was when he said, "I fight for the users." How do you fight for your users?
Yeah, well, you know, I think that that's something that we all have a passion for, is like, how do we provide a great experience to the people who will use the services that we design? And I think we often feel like we are in opposition to kind of the business, you know, that often is sort of like, we sort of feel like our job is to stand up for something that will be manipulative or abusive of users. And I think that the best outcomes, right, are things that can align business interests with customer interests as perfectly as possible. And a lot of times what that means is that the route of attack for defending the user is to talk in the language of the business. Because frankly, people aren't going to be like, you know, when you sort of are talking to the person who is like spending the serious coin to build the service, it's sort of like, well, I don't know if users are going to like that. You know, I don't know if that's really going to delight people. You know, they don't care.
Right.
Or it's like, well, I think, you know, the user experience principles say this. It's like, you got to sort of say, but so what does it mean for the business? You know, it's like, I think part of the thing, and we see this a lot of times with people who identify themselves as quote unquote creative and somehow splitting that away from the interest of the business, often put arguments in ways that are not aligned with the business. And, you know, design is about persuasion. It's about persuasion on the one hand of sort of, you know, persuading people who are using the product to continue using it. But it's also about selling the design to the people who are buying it or paying for it. Mm. And it means that you sort of have to have empathy for those folks, not just for users, and understand, you know, what their motivations are and put our arguments in that context. You know, how does the boss get their bonus for the year? You know, that's, you know, what are their metrics for success, and how do you align user interests with those interests? That's the trick of good design.
Absolutely. And I love the reminder about knowing why you're doing what you're doing and being able to actually sell that and pitch that, because that's a big part of our work too. Unless, you know, we're working for ourselves or we're an artist or something. I mean, we're serving people and we're solving problems. So being able to really present your work in a way that's convincing and also has empathy for the user, I think that's a great, great reminder.
Yeah. You put that so well. And I think that while we often think that it's our job to have empathy for the user, period, I think having empathy for the people who we're working for is important too. I mean, empathy is a 360 degree thing.
Absolutely. Josh, how do you measure the success of your design?
Yeah, I think it really kind of goes to how well does it actually align, you know, user and business interests. I see a lot of examples that don't. I mean, for better or worse, we have a lot of business models right now that are built around businesses that aren't actually related to why people come to the service. You know, so you have media sites, for example, whose business is built on advertising, and as advertising inventory has essentially reached infinity and prices are dropping, you start to get this thing where that we didn't used to see, which is advertising being really invasive, really abusive, hurting the user experience. And so it actually getting in the way of why people come to a media site. You know, how can you create an advertising experience that is at least not abusive, but even better, how can you create a business model that maybe gives people the content they want in a fair exchange? You know, and that's a real puzzle right now, figuring out how content sites will work, because people have shown that they won't pay for it. So what? You know, because right now it's like the business model is damaging to the user experience. And we see that too, you know, I mean, things with data-driven sites like Facebook or Google, where, you know, you come to Google for a great email experience or calendar experience, but they want you to come so that they can use that data to sell you different, better advertising or to do all kinds of different stuff that they maybe haven't even figured out yet. And so, you know, at least it's not totally in alignment with user interests in the way that, say, Apple or Amazon, it's a more direct one-to-one relationship. You know, Apple wants you to buy their products. They're going to give you as good an experience and complete as experience as possible. Amazon wants you to buy stuff, so they're going to give you a pretty straight-up retail experience. And that really has implications for what you've got permission to do, right? Like, so me personally, I would be more comfortable having one of those Amazon Echoes in my living room. If you're not familiar, it's, you know, one of these things that you talk to it. You know, you say, hey, Alexa, tell me, you know, what's the weather, or add this to my shopping cart.
Yeah, need more teepee.
Yeah, right. More comfortable with that than I am with Google listening in on my conversations. Because Amazon, sure, I understand what they're up to. You know, it's like their interests are pretty aligned with my interests, you know. I want to buy stuff. They want to sell me stuff. Google, it's not clear what's happening with my data. There's this uncertainty. So anyway, I would say that the thing that most pleases me is when there's a great user experience that is aligned with the business model, and so everybody wins. And it's a lot harder and rarer than you would think.
Absolutely. Now, this is the last question of this segment, but it's a big one. And I actually can't wait to ask you this question, because I know this is really in your wheelhouse. What does the future of UX look like to you, Josh?
Well, you know, I think that it's not about screens. You know, I think that we tend to think that our job is to design screens, you know, that UX people design flows from screen to screen. And that's not what our job is. That's the form that it's taken for the last few years. Our job is designing how people interact with information. And that point of interaction is changing and exploding. So it could be that, you know, that it's going to be that the room is going to be wired in some way that will just sort of passively understand what I want or do. You know, we're starting to see that with some of the sort of smart home things that are emerging, or the objects that I wear or that I manipulate, you know, that these are going to become interfaces. And, you know, we're also seeing things like speech and natural gesture and, you know, camera vision, all these different ways that the machines can gather input, which means that the output will be different too. So, while we've kind of traditionally understood everything about talking to a screen, you know, our digital APIs have been attached solely to screens, we're now entering this world where we're getting physical interfaces for those digital APIs, which, you know, if you thought that designing an interface for both mobile and desktop was hard, you know, think about now designing an interface for everything in a room, or for the room itself, or for a city. And so what it means is having a really large sense of what the physical context is for somebody in a place, you know, what they're doing in that space, how they're feeling in that space, much more than just sort of how they are confined in a two-dimensional environment. We're having to think in 3D, or if you add time, in 4D, how this works. So our job is about to become a lot more complex, but also a lot more intimate and a lot more entwined in people's lives, which means that we need to really apply good values and thinking about what we're building and to what end, because this stuff is going to start to enter into the most intimate spaces of our lives and homes and even our bodies.
Wow. I need to like just pause for a moment to let that all sink in. That's deep. Deep answer. I can't wait to listen back to that and share that with the audience. Josh, let's wrap up the show with superpowers. What's your most... Yes. I mean, Dr. Touch. Let's
thank you. Thank you. I think.
I guess it's better than Dr. Feelgood.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't know. That's pretty good.
Arguable.
That's right. In certain situations, they are related.
Sure. In your marriage.
That's right.
Josh, what's your most invincible UX resource or tool you can recommend to our listeners?
Well, you know, I mean, spending time with people. I mean, that's what it's all about, right? It's like the thing is that design is all hypothesis. It's all guesswork, you know, and we're informed more and more by our own experiences or the experiences of the field, but it doesn't mean anything until you actually go and you spend some time with people to find out what their needs are and how well your proposed solution works. And I think that there is often, I can't explain it, there's often a reluctance to go out and spend time with people where they live with the services you're creating, or that it seems like it's a nice to have, but that is what it is all about. That's where the rubber meets the road. And so the one way to make sure that you are creating something that people need and want to use is to talk to them.
Yeah. Great answer. And I think that's one of those things we don't do enough of, in our work, is just talking to people, that we want and we intend on using our products we're creating. And I think I heard something on Twitter, I can't remember who put it out there, but it was like, launching a product without testing it is like getting in a cab and saying, just drive.
It's true. You know, you don't know what you've made. You know, you've made it for yourself. You know, you think it's okay.
Yeah.
And the thing I will say is that, not everybody likes doing it. I mean, frankly, not everybody likes talking to people. That's sure. Okay. And I'm not even talking about professionally. It's just like, if you're introverted, it's uncomfortable or, you know, whatever. It's all right if you're not the person who does the research, you know, but you should at least value it and find somebody who is great at it, who does like to sort of go out, who has that curiosity about people, because, the information that comes back and the surprises and the insights, the goal is to confirm or disprove your hypothesis. It's straight up scientific method stuff. Mm.
Josh, I'm going to recommend your book highly, but if you could recommend one book to our listeners, what would it be and why?
Wow. You know, I've had a couple of books that have been really thought provoking. So I'm going to use my superpower to bend reality and just ask me to mention three books instead of.
Oh, seven. Okay.
One of them is a book called Enchanted Objects by David Rose from MIT. That came out last year. And it's just a sort of fun sort of thought experiment that kind of looks at, you know, what if we think about the connected devices that we have now as magic instead of technology. So it's something that leads with human needs and desires instead of technology. And really, if you think about it, when you connect a regular everyday object, or even the phone is a great example of this, it becomes sort of blessed. It becomes this magical thing that can talk to this other world, the digital world. And so he looks at all these kinds of ways that we can draw inspiration from the centuries of myth and legend and stories we've been telling each other. Design patterns, really. You know, what's a magic mirror? We already know. We've been telling each other this for centuries. Really sort of interesting, thought-provoking, fun book. Also on this physical digital stuff, there's a book called Designing Connected Products by Claire Rowland, which is, it's from O'Reilly. It's huge. It's like this tome, like 800 or 900 pages that really explains sort of all kinds of stuff between UX and data and networking and all sort of every aspect of designing a connected device, which whether or not you're doing it, it's just like a really interesting way to understand where this world is going. And then the third thing I'll mention is really more of a thriller. Came out a few years ago, so people might be familiar with it, called The Circle by David Eggers. And it's, you know, it's fun. It's a potboiler. It's a page-turner. But it's really kind of about the idea of, to what end are we gathering and sharing all this personal data? And you know, it's sort of like a Google-like company that's run by three founders with three very different motivations in this. And it really is sort of a thriller. It's a fun little book, but I think it's thought-provoking about, you know, what kind of world are we trying to make.
That's good. I can't wait to check those out. Josh, go ahead.
And you mentioned my book, which
yes, please.
Thank you for that. Designing for Touch, and we've got a discount code for your listeners.
Yes,
and we'll share that I think in show notes. And,
yes, we
and
will
later. But want to thank people for making it all the way through me flapping my lips for so long by giving a discount for this book about sort of the new guidelines and perspective we need to think about designing for touchscreens.
Oh, thank you so much for offering that, Josh. I know our defenders are going to absolutely take advantage of that that generous offer there.
Yay!
I'll be sure to put that in the show notes, guys and gals. Last question for you, Josh. And this is one of my favorite ones because this is sort of encapsulates the reason that I'm doing this show is to really try to help designers stay inspired in their work. As you touched on so eloquently and deeply about where we're going and how much harder our work is going to get. You know, what is your best advice for aspiring UX design superheroes?
You know, I will come back to sort of thinking about the people who you're designing for. You know, what are the needs that they have? The best way to find out is to talk to them and observe them. They may not necessarily be able to articulate it as directly as sort of like, here's what I need. Here's the solution that I want. But by sort of watching them in their lives, you'll see where they have problems that need to be solved. And I think that is the thing, is to think about what kind of world do you want to make? Because we are shaping the interface to information and to one another in ways that are going to become increasingly intimate. And so be thoughtful about the values that you want to embed in your systems, because software is political, it's ideological, it has a point of view. And think about the kind of company that you want to work for and the kind of services that you want to create to make the world better. What kind of world do you want to make? And listen to people and think about how to help them. Mm.
Josh, as we close, why don't you tell our audience the best way to connect and to keep up with you?
You can find out more about me at bigmedium.com, and I tweet at bigmediumjosh.
Sweet. So I just want to personally thank you so much, Josh, for all of your contributions to our community. And I know you've just scratched the surface and you've done so much, and you are a superhero for sure. And and I just thank you for that. I know that our listeners will agree, especially those who may not know your work and are going to be exposed to it for the first time, possibly through this show. So I just appreciate you so much. And I just thank you for being here today. It's been an awesome pleasure chatting with you.
Well, thank you, Jason. Thanks for bringing together so many thoughtful people on both sides of the microphone. Really appreciate it. You're a superhero.
Bless you, man.
And you also have like a wonderful voice for this. I have to say, you have this sultry tones that I think are suited to this. So I'm sure you have superpowers beyond that, but that's a pretty good one, too.
Thanks, man. That means a lot. All right. Well, hey, I just want to say thanks again and fight on, my friend.
Fight on.
Wow, right? How about that interview with Josh Clark? So grateful that Josh took the time to talk to me, and I learned so much from him, and I'm just so inspired myself by the things he shared as it relates to touch and devices and invisible UIs and just what the future is looking like for us as UX designers. Anyway, I'm sure you enjoyed it. If you did, would you leave a rating and review on iTunes, and even just let me know through Twitter or email? I would love to hear your thoughts and your feedback. It helps push me on to continue coming out with this great content. The links to these things are in the show notes. By the way, I gotta mention this. Josh generously offered a 15% off coupon code for his brand new book, Designing for Touch. I'm going to put that link in the show notes for sure, because that is so cool. That's all I got. Thanks so much for listening. I just want to say, until next week, fight on, my friends.